You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. Hi, everyone. Before we get started with today's episode, I just have a few things to cover. These are frightening times for our country, and I'm looking for recommendations. I'm especially interested in learning from artists who are also activists. If you know someone who is finding a way to give back, to work for change, please contact me through The Compass Facebook page or website. I would love to hear their stories and learn more from their efforts. Also, I'll be launching the Compass Podcast Patreon page this week, so keep an eye on our social media accounts for the announcement. Patreon is a way for people who are listeners of The Compass to support its mission. The podcast will always be free, but if you find it valuable in your life as an artist and would like to make an ongoing monthly contribution, you can give $1 a month, $5 a month, whatever you like. I'm looking forward to reimagining and deepening the conversation in the third year of the podcast, so please join me in that space. You'll also have access to bonus content if you choose to become a patron of The Compass. My guest today is Lucy Baker. Lucy is a dancer, teacher, and choreographer. We went to Juilliard together, and she's a magnetic performer and someone who's always taken the initiative in creating her own work, which I really admire. She's based in Seattle these days, so this was recorded over Skype. You can see more of her work at lucybaker.com. That's Lucy with an I-E. I hope you enjoy the 90th episode of The Compass. And what is the dark side for you most often?
That's more of the question for me, is what is the dark side? And in reflecting on that question you sent me earlier, I came to the conclusion that for me it's sort of a sense of meaninglessness or like purposelessness, especially in regards to art making, in that like nobody cares, none of this means anything, it's a waste of time, and everything that you're sacrificing for it is ridiculous, you know?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
That's an easy place to go sometimes.
Yeah, so for me, that's what I imagine when I hear the term dark side and referring to my art, is... Because for me... Art making is a lot about communication. It's a lot about being with people and having a connection, being impactful. And so, if I feel like there's no impact, no connection, then I feel like, why am I doing this?
Right.
And then everything kind of falls apart. So to avoid that sense of meaninglessness, which is, you know, sometimes unavoidable, or at least how I approach that, I'll say that, how I approach that sense of meaninglessness kind of varies depending on my state of being. I try to reframe it so that it has meaning for me personally, so that it's not so much about the affirmation of other people or the need for other people to understand what I'm doing or like it or be involved with it at all, and try to make it enough that it's meaningful for me, that it impacts my life, and I find it important, and try to have that be enough.
Yeah.
That is, you know, easier said than done.
No, but it is the biggest and most important step, I think. The most basic step.
Yeah.
But you're right, it is, especially when we're trying to make this our livings and careers, difficult to do. Mm-hmm. Well, you're someone who I've always admired so much because in my observation, you always take a lot of risks in just making your own work. And that's so inspiring to me. Even those moments where I can feel isolated, to be like, well, Lucy's just, she just had an idea and she's going for it. She's not waiting for someone else. I should do that.
Yeah.
Is that something that you feel like you've always been able to take the initiative with? Or has it been kind of later in your career that you've found that?
No, I feel like I always had a tendency to kind of do my own thing. Like, I would just get a wild hair of an idea and just like, okay, this is what's happening. And actually, as I've gotten older and I'm looking back on the things that I have done, I'm like, really? That was the choice you made? You just went and did those things? Okay. So, it seems to be some part of my personality or a habit I have of, I'm extremely stubborn. Mm-hmm. So if somebody tells me that I can't do something, then I immediately go out and do it to the best of my ability, you know. So that's just part of who I am. And I just find it interesting to be engaging with things that I don't understand or learning and not knowing what I'm doing is something that I value, actually. And when I feel secure and like competent and comfortable, then I get kind of bored. Hmm. So I actively seek out things that challenge me and sort of disrupt my patterns of comfort.
Do you enjoy the producerial tasks that come along with doing that?
You mean like managing projects and fundraising? Yeah. And
how have you kind of figured all of that out and made it not drive you crazy?
I don't mind it so much, the production aspect. I'm pretty organized. I like organizing things. I like analyzing things and like making them very square, you know. That I find that satisfying. Probably the hardest task in producing my own work as a choreographer, or if I'm producing like teaching workshops or something like that, is dealing with fundraising or money. Fundraising is hard because it never ends.
Yes.
No, like, it's not the kind of thing you can, like, mark off your checklist and then it's over.
Quote of the night.
Yeah.
Fundraising is hard because it never ends.
It never ends. And that's just the fact of it. And that's what makes it so draining, you know? Like, you can't just get the money and be done with it. You have to constantly be asking and finding new resources and petitioning people for help and support and deciding why your work is important or why it should be valued in that way. And that can be exhausting because yeah. It's just a constant justification of your work. And I have, in the last year or so, sort of like taken a break from that. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go be a student and not be justifying everything I'm doing to people who don't know me and don't really understand what I'm doing. But that said, the way that I think about it, that frames it in a way that sort of feeds me energy rather than drains me of my energy, is to think of it as though, hey, this is a project that I'm really excited about, I'm really inspired by, and I think it would be exciting for you to hear about it too. You know, some like beautiful secret that I want to share with someone, rather than like me trying to get something out of you.
Right.
So I've tried to think of it that way and tried to make it as fun as possible, you know, a collaborative effort with those who are supporting me rather than me constantly giving away my energy.
Yeah. What do you mean by that, a collaborative effort?
Well, I can't make the work unless they help me, right? So my input into whether it's a dance production or a teaching workshop or a dinner party, there's a dialogue there. The other party has to show up, has to invest their energy also. So that has an effect on what's created. So they're just as much of a creator as I am in that sense. Maybe not on the aesthetic or the content per se, but definitely in how it's manifested.
Yeah. No, that's a really smart way to think about it. So you're in Seattle these days, which is where you're from. Mm-hmm. And you used to be in New York when we knew each other. Well, we still know each other, but when we first met, I mean. And you've been back in Seattle now for how many years?
I moved out of New York 3 years ago.
3 years ago. What is the geographic change? How has it affected you and your work?
Oh.
Or your state of mind or everything?
Well, moving out of New York was a big transition on a lot of fronts. The inspiration for that was a desire to sort of redefine my relationship to my work and my career and my life generally. Just sort of what kind of a life did I want to live? Because the freelancing scenario in New York wasn't as well-rounded or sustainable emotionally, financially, artistically, as I wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt the need to change that. I came back to Seattle because my family is here, and I had been away from them for 10 years. And also because it's a lot closer to wilderness than New York. And that's something I value. The company of trees and mountains and oceans. And not that New York doesn't have those things, and I definitely found my little havens in the city, but it's just on a different scale. And being close to nature in that way has been really helpful. That said, Seattle right now is going through a major transformation. The city is exploding with new business, with new people. It's growing at an incredible rate. And so the energy in the city right now is very different from what it was when I grew up there. And they're like tearing down all kinds of buildings. They're throwing up high rises. The traffic is insane. You know, there's a number of things going on that are kind of unsettling for me as somebody who grew up here. So I've been encountering that here as well. And, you know, I miss my artist tribe from New York that I developed, you know, people like you and others that I got really close with. And another thing I noticed when I left New York was how much I had invested in those relationships. I definitely sort of took them for granted. And, you know, now I realize just how valuable they are. You know, the time you put into those relationships is important.
Yeah, well, not just for emotional support as your friends, but also, like, so much of your work is collaborative, and to have those people that if you have an idea, you have collaborators there who are always willing to jump in.
Yeah, and who we share similar philosophies about making work, and I can trust, and the quality of their work I can trust, you know. So, that just takes time to build and time to find those people, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little different here, finding new people. I was just sort of, like, changing tack, also.
Yeah, you were ready for something very different.
Yeah. So, you know, I was back, let's see, what have I been doing? I spent the first year out of New York traveling quite a bit, and I was trying to get work in Europe, actually, which didn't happen. And then I came back to Seattle and worked in Seattle for a year, just freelancing and teaching. And then this past year, I was training in expressive arts therapy at the Tomalpa Institute in Marin County in California.
How long were you there?
I was there for 9 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to hear all about that because I haven't really gotten to talk to you about it.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
I mean, and you're in Marin County, which is gorgeous.
Also gorgeous, yeah. And the Institute was founded by Anna Halpern and her daughter Daria Halpern, and it's at Anna's house, you know, it's on her famous dance deck in the woods. And it was a very different way of working than with dance than I had ever worked before. And it was really interesting.
What is the goal of the training?
So it's expressive arts therapy in there. They've developed a sort of technology around it that they refer to as the life art process. So it's using creative arts practices, specifically dance, creative writing, and drawing or visual art to process life experience and sort of potentially heal wounds or transform things in your life using art. Daria is trained as a psychologist, as a therapist, and Anna is the artist. So it's sort of bringing those two worlds together.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
How many people were studying there with you?
Well, they have several different programs, but the group that I completed my training with was about 19 people.
Well, and now you're about to go get your master's in dance. Or you,
yes.
You already started, you just told me, in June.
I started my MFA program at the University of Washington this year, and it's a two-year program, and it focuses on teaching in higher education. But it's also pretty broad. We're encouraged to go out into the university and sort of see what we see and how that might be related to dance in different ways.
So is it more about eventually teaching, like, dance theory or dance history or something like that, rather than like the actual physical dance classes? Or is it
depends
both?
Depends on the person.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of teaching of technique. We teach dance classes the entire time.
Oh, cool.
Graduate students are kind of a big part of the undergrad faculty, so there's a lot of that. But the master's sort of thesis project is to design and then teach a course. And that could be a dance history course, it could be an anatomy course, it could be, you know, a seminar on pedagogy. It's really quite broad.
Have you even begun to think about what that might be yet? I know you're right at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to leave room to be open to what the university has to offer, but the idea was to sort of link it into the training that I was doing at Tomalpa and pursue this idea of dance within community, within social interaction, the fabric of culture, how our bodies are living monuments to our lives, our life experience, and how that affects our relationships and the ways we communicate.
Hmm.
So that's extremely broad. but that's what I imagine I would be sort of swimming in.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's exciting.
When did you first start enjoying teaching? Because it sounds like you're kind of going down a route right now where that's going to become a more prominent part of your life.
Yeah, I started teaching with ArtReach, which evolved into A-Step, mm-hmm. right? Which you know all about. So that was a very particular kind of experience. Teaching with artists striving to end poverty is collaborative, right? So you're working with artists of different disciplines and you're team teaching. So you have a lot of communal dynamics within the classroom. You're working with kids who are coming from impoverished communities or disadvantaged communities. And so the focus is not really on like the achievement of mechanistic technique. So that's where my teaching practice started. and has kind of remained there. And also in dance land, we're constantly teaching each other movement. So just peer to peer. So having this sort of sense of breaking down movement, what does it mean? How do I translate it to your body? That kind of dialogue was present throughout my dance training. So watching bodies, understanding movement, being able to break that down, being able to translate that to another body is really fascinating for me. I mean, I love anatomy, I love kinesiology, like all of those things are so cool. So that's fun for me to like break that down and to see somebody's body change. Like this summer at UW, I was assigned to teach Dance 102, which is like an introductory sampler class to the undergrads. And most of my students had never been in a dance studio before, had never seen dance, had like no idea what it was. They just signed up for credit. You know, they needed arts credits or whatever it was. And, you know, in the beginning, I'm like a little bit worried for them because they're so uncoordinated. And like, you know, I say right hand and they move their left foot and it's just like a little mess. But by the end of the 2 months, they're like completely different people. You know, you can see them taking space in a much more confident way, in a much more dynamic way. You can just see the quality of their musculature has changed, their alignment, their skeletal alignment has changed, the way they interact with each other has changed. And that's just like extremely exciting for me. Really, my secret goal is to like change the world through dance.
Well, we could use it right now.
Yeah, honestly, that's facing what we're facing in the political arena. I'm so grateful that I am a dancer and that I have like committed to this path because it makes a lot of sense to me that, you know, people, if they're connected to their bodies, they're connected to their humanity. And there's no better place to do that than in a dance class, in my mind, because it's marrying, you know, the physicality with creativity. So it's very inspiring and I really enjoy it. And sort of my curiosity now is how to strengthen that connection between the humanity and the art making, rather than it being sort of esoteric and inaccessible and, you know, alienating. I'm not interested in that.
I mean, I find watching professional dancers so inspiring to watch extreme pieces where you're doing things that a normal person could never ever do. But I think it's, you know, there's two extremes and they're both really valuable. I love that you're drawn to connecting with people who maybe don't have the training and seeing the vast change it can make. Because I know, like when we did the piece together in New York that you put me in, Restless Night, like, and you worked with 3 non-dancers or like limited dance training actors and puppeteers. One, it was just such an honor that you would allow us to like play as dancers. But it's just another form of storytelling. And then I know the work you did in what became the documentary Enter the Fawn is kind of that from another way as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about either of those experiences and watching that transformation? Sorry, that's not very specific.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that it was an honor to be invited to dance, you know?
I mean, you know, I love to like dance on a dance, like cut a rug on a dance floor, but whenever dancers allow me to be a part of their world, I get very excited.
Right, but how interesting is that? You know, that there's somehow there's a boundary there that requires somebody to invite you into, which I find that fascinating because you're in your body all the time. Right. So you could dance, you know, air quotes here, you can't see them, but you could dance like dancers dance whenever you wanted. Like there's literally nobody standing behind your shoulder being like, hey, you can't do that. you have to only move like you usually move or the way other people told you. Like, no, but there's no person doing that. So I just find it really interesting that there is this sort of resistance or boundary or fear or whatever it is that prevents people from connecting to their bodies in this sort of creative, aesthetic way. And I'm like so curious about investigating that. And what's also funny is that the reason I wanted to work with three actors for that piece was because I wanted to work with people who had experience with emotional life, with the construction of emotional life and an imaginary life for character work, which is something that I felt I needed you to give me permission to do, you know? So it's like, and of course I have an emotional life and an imaginary life all the time. Like, that's not a thing that I don't have, but right. I needed, like, your permission to work on that. So this is another reason why I love collaboration, right? We give each other permission to go into worlds that we may not be able to alone, right? We support each other in this sort right. of, like, crossing of boundaries, you know, this, yeah. we can be nomads, together, you know, which is so, it's just so interesting. These, like, we make these rules for ourselves that we can break so easily. But it's somehow necessary to have others to support each other to do that. So, mm-hmm. So I find that interesting. And working on that piece was super fun. And I was really struck by how little direction you all needed, you know, like I would give just sort of like the hint of an idea and then you would just like fill it out, you know, with all kinds of like beautiful choices, you know. And that's something that dancers aren't trained to do in Western concert dance. Like, we're trained to, like, learn the moves and then do the moves. And this practice of sort of filling the room with your imagination is not something that we practice very often. Of course, that's not true of all styles or of all people or of all schools, but in general, I would say that it's not as accessible for most dance artists to work that way. So that was really fascinating. And actually, like, going to Tamalpa and working in arts therapy was sort of a continuation of that desire to explore the emotional realm and to understand it better, understand the sort of power of that and also the power of imagination, how you can sort of transform what you're feeling or build a story around what you're feeling that frames it in a different way. So, yeah, so that was kind of, like, the seed of where I'm still, like, working on that material. You know, it's been, like, 3-4 years, but I'm still, like, working on that idea.
Yeah.
Which is exciting. And then you mentioned Enter the Faun. So that was a documentary that was created during the process of choreographing a piece called Diagnosis of a Faun, which was made by a choreographer named Tamar Rogoff. And it was featured an actor with cerebral palsy whose name is Greg Mosgala. He played the character of the Faun. And it was sort of a meditation on the meeting of science, medical science, and art, and where healing is in that relationship. So again, this is where my life has been sort of moving towards this meeting of healing and art.
Yeah.
And that piece was an important piece for me in my career. You know, we worked on it for several years and toured it, and I later worked with Tamar on other projects as a company manager, and, you know, I'm very close to all the cast members in that, you know, Greg and also the other dancer, Emily Pope Blackman, and Dr. Don Kalish, who's so sweet and a real live doctor, and I had to train him how to do classical partnering. We did an excerpt of Sleeping Beauty pas de deux in that show, and I was in pointe shoes and in a tutu and the whole thing, and he totally did it. And that was really interesting, sort of like auditioning doctors. We had to audition doctors for that role, and I would work with them a little bit and, like, teach them a few simple partnering phrases. And I could just immediately tell whether or not they had, like, the sensitivity in their bodies and in their hands to be able to take care of me when I was on point.
That's so interesting, the way you phrase that.
Yeah. Because some of them were really available to that, and some of them were really not. They had just no idea what to do. Or they approached it in different ways. Like, we were working with a surgeon who really wanted to know exactly how everything was working. He wanted me to break it down and, like, be very explicit about every single movement. And then, like, Dr. Don just was sort of like, he would just kind of get in there and he would be making adjustments. And then there was another doctor who was more of a lecturer. He was more of a research doctor, and it was just like he was totally out to lunch. I could have been like halfway across the room and he wouldn't have noticed.
It's just fascinating since their careers are about the human body.
Yeah.
But
yeah. It's a very different way of approaching the body.
Yeah. All right. This is all coming together. This is all making sense.
There's a through line somewhere, yeah. I guess.
And is the documentary online somewhere that people could see or buy it, or?
There's a website, enterthefawn.com.
Okay, that so you can look there.
Get more information about. There have been screenings across many different platforms since it's come out, but I'm sure you can get a copy online. It's really great. There's also a trailer. You can check it out. And yeah, they also have this outreach programming that goes along with the documentary, reaching out into the disability community, the medical community, and the dance or arts community.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really great project.
Do you have any artistic mentors that you've collected over the years that have really influenced the way you've tried to structure your life as an artist?
Like role models for living as an artist? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, maybe somebody, I guess it could be just professional goals, or somebody who you feel like just the way they deal with their everyday life as a creative person, the energy they have, the way they deal with the stress of it or the difficulty of it is inspiring to you.
I mean, there's so many people that come to mind, and for different reasons, you know? And it's not necessarily that I would want to be like them. It's just that, you know, I admire them and what they've been able to build for themselves. I mean, like, Tamar is a good example. Like, she's been making, like, large-scale community-based dance theater works for decades, you know? And that's, like, incredibly inspiring to me, like, just to keep your hat in the ring, you know.
Yeah.
Her work is always connected to, like, an important theme, you know, just sort of life theme. And I appreciate the way how she doesn't, like, compromise the scale of her vision, you know, like, for a diagnosis of a fawn, she really wanted to work with a doctor. And, you know, when the first doctor bailed, she went and found another doctor. You know, she doesn't give up when things sort of fall through, because I think that's sort of the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
When you're trying to make something, like, things will always fall through, but something else will always come up. She's made pieces in, like, giant water tanks in Lincoln Center. She made pieces on, like, rooftops and gardens of the Lower East Side with, like, children and the elderly and, like, everybody in between, you know. She went to just all kinds of places. She's made pieces with babies, you know. You want to talk about a logistical nightmare? Let's put, like, 12 babies in the piece, you know. So I admire that about her. And also how she's really involved her family in her life and her art making. Her family is extremely important to her, and they've all been, like, in her pieces and things like that. You know?
Yeah.
So, she's one.
Is there, like, any lesson that you've learned over the past couple years that you're really proud of?
A lesson that I've learned?
Yeah. Or, like, a change that you've made that you're like, oh, I'm so glad I finally did that. This works so much better.
I guess what comes to mind when you ask me that
is allowing myself to know what I know and to feel what I feel. Because there's so much doubt in living this life.
Yeah.
Where it, living in a profession that is not valued by our culture and is has so many difficulties wrapped up in it. So allowing myself to be the expert of my own experience has been something that I'm really working on.
I love that. Like
trying to internalize.
Yeah.
And that's been really fruitful to take what I'm feeling seriously rather than sort of like, oh, that's just, like, I'll get over it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, no, maybe you won't. And even so, like, pay attention, you know? Like, what you're feeling is important. You know, it's like a signpost to, you know, an issue that needs addressing. So, because a lot of people will tell me that I'm like, oh, Lucy, you're so sensitive. I'm like, yeah, that's right, I'm sensitive. And that's an asset.
Yeah, that's what makes me a great artist.
Asset that allows me to, like, learn and grow and, like, figure out what's going on in my world.
Yeah.
But
that's definitely something that isn't valued in our culture.
Exactly. And, you know, people say it like it's a, some sort of a weakness, like a bad thing. But I've been reframing that for myself as... No, it's not a weakness. It's a, it's an asset. It's a resource. And, yeah, just sort of avoiding letting people sort of tell me what I feel or what I'm experiencing. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Only I know what I'm feeling and what I'm experiencing. And allowing myself the time to really identify that and reflect. Because sometimes it's confusing. You know, there's just, like, so many feelings that you're just like, I don't even know what's happening. So it's not, like, a simple task. It, like, requires space and time and effort to really sort of, like, sit down and contemplate some stuff, you know, figure out what's going on. Not even sit down, like, I don't have to sit down to contemplate. Sometimes it involves moving and dancing and understanding my world through my body.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's been something that recently I've been trying to give value to.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, you gotta know what you know.
Well, I mean, this is only because you said the word value, but something else that I was really loved that you felt strongly about when we did that piece together was paying your artists.
Yeah.
And I know that's something that is really important to you.
Yes.
How have you managed to make that central to your process or to negotiate those moments when... people are asking you to bend your principles. Either in getting paid as an artist or paying others as an artist, I guess.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I have a maybe not so unique, but I imagine unique perspective in that I am a creator and also someone who works for other people as a dancer, so I understand both sides of the equation. And for me, it's extremely important to pay the people I'm asking to dance for me what I the minimum that I would require from somebody else. That just makes sense to me. And also I find that it really changes the atmosphere in the room, right? And there's a different sort of sense of respect that's paid to on both sides.
Yeah.
So that's valuable for me. I need to have that respect in the studio when I'm making work. You know, I don't want to feel like beholden to the dancers or like pleading for their acceptance, and they don't want to feel like I'm taking advantage of them. Yeah, so I talk with the dancers at the beginning of a project. I tell them, this is what I have to offer. This is the expectations as far as rehearsals and performances go. Are you comfortable with that? And so we have a conversation about it, and I do it up front, and it's very clear. And for me as a dancer, And especially moving back to Seattle, there isn't as much funding here for work, and the practice is usually paying dancers a couple $100s per performance, but not for rehearsal. And for me, I made sort of a rule for myself that I would not work for free anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm just not going to do that anymore. And when I first got out of school, you know, you're just trying to get your feet wet, I would work for performance pay, but didn't demand rehearsal pay. But now I do. But in coming to Seattle, I recognize that the culture here is different than in New York, and the resources are more limited. And so when a choreographer would approach me and ask me to dance with them, I would start with a conversation about compensation. And I made the offer that if they didn't have the money to pay me, that we could come up with a barter, some sort of exchange. Hmm. So one of the choreographers that I worked with is an excellent writer. And so she paid me the amount that she could, and whatever she couldn't, she made up for it in hours of editing my grants, you know. So when I was applying for stuff, she would help me review it, and that was extremely valuable to me. You know, I really needed that help also. Yeah. So we struck up a bargain where we both felt our work was being valued. And, you know, we had a conversation, and it makes deepens the relationship between the two of us. So,
no, I think it was so much better.
Really valuable process.
Just to state it up front instead of becoming resentful about it.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not into resentment. But it is, you know, tricky business, and. You know, I've had conversations with choreographers where at the end of our negotiations, they felt they couldn't offer me that kind of exchange, and so I didn't work with them, you know. So I did give up projects because I had made that boundary for myself. But at this point in my career, that's something that I'm willing to accept. And there are choreographers who, you know, maybe getting paid by them is not so important to me, or it's a very small gig that doesn't require a lot of time and energy, or, you know, they're like, it's a constant negotiation. There's not like a set, like, this is how I will work all the time, always. No. But the important thing, as you said, is to like start the conversation and to be honest with myself about my boundaries in that way, because I don't want to feel taken advantage of. And I have my skills are extremely valuable, and I've put a lot of effort into that. So, you know.
Exactly.
That's like worth at least having a conversation about. And for me, it's also a bit about changing the culture around it a little bit. You know, if one dancer is having a conversation with a choreographer about it, then like maybe that could encourage other dancers too, or maybe it'll encourage the choreographer to approach their dancers in a different way. It's baby steps.
Yeah, no, I hope it encourages the people listening to think about the way that they're the way that they're working.
Yeah, because for the most part, when I approach choreographers about pay, it's not like they're like, oh no, I can't talk about this. How dare you? This is ridiculous. Nobody's like responding.
Money doesn't exist.
Money doesn't exist. How dare you? I mean, it can be hard for people to talk about, especially if they don't have the money and they really want to make the piece. You
yeah,
know, I understand that, but. You gotta have the hard conversations sometimes.
Yeah.
So, and for me, as far as making work, I take my budget into consideration when I think about the scale of my project. So if I don't have the money to pay for 20 dancers to rehearse for 6 months, then I'm not gonna make a piece for 20 dancers and rehearse for 6 months, you know? So I've been working much smaller scale with, like, you know, trios and finding ways to find space that's more affordable for rent and like these kinds of other things. So my budget is part of my creative practice, which I think is also extremely important to include that in the vision, you know, rather than just sort of like, oh, I have this idea and people will help make it happen regardless of how much it costs. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's just not how I work.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting that it's, kind of finding that balance when you were talking about the woman that you worked with, Tamar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, like, the grand scope of her ideas. But it doesn't necessarily have to be the scope of expense.
Right.
They can still be large ideas and risky ideas without costing an arm and a leg.
Right. And when I made Project Ruin with Carly Eckert, she and I really wanted to put on the show that we wanted to make, right? And we didn't want to compromise on our vision because of the money. But because we had decided that, we gave ourselves a much longer time scale for fundraising. So instead of like, oh, we're going to get the money in like 6 months and like pay people no money, we're like, okay, we're going to take a year, 2 years to get the money together and do this the way we, at the level that we want it to be.
Yeah.
Right? So expanding the time frame of the project made a huge difference, right? Rather than putting the pressure on ourselves to like get the money together in a short amount of time, which really isn't possible, especially with grant cycles. There's just like, you can't get the money that fast. So, but it expanding the time frame sort of gave us the ability to achieve what we wanted to achieve. So that's kind of what I mean by like including the budget into the process of creating the piece. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean you make it for less money. It just means that it's part of the equation.
Yeah.
Right. And being sensitive to that, and time scale is also important.
Yeah.
And that's another thing with Tamar. Like, these projects of hers last several years. You know, it's not like a few months and you're done, you know. And I think a lot of dance artists work that way because it takes so much to invest in the creation of a dance piece. Like, you don't have a script beforehand. Like, a lot of it is invented on the people in the room. It's site-specific sometimes, you know. So that kind of work requires a lot of time and space.
Do you have any advice for artists who may have never applied for a grant before? Like, resources you found, or just tips?
Read the grant application thoroughly.
Step number one.
Really. Like, every time I would go to a grant writing workshop, or if you look up, like, webinars or whatever, there are a lot of resources in that way. That's always the first thing they say. They're like, really do your research on the granting organization, one. Like, do they even fund projects like the ones you're talking about? What are their values? What are the things they're interested in? And really, like, catering your writing to that organization specifically. That's just a huge deal in doing your research for, like, who the audience is for this grant. That's the number one. Read the application thoroughly. And also, the other thing that I definitely learned when working with Tamar was you can call them up. Just call the grant organization, and if you have a question or you're unclear, ask. That's what they're there for. They, like, want you to have a successful application. So ask them questions. Work on it well in advance so you have the time to not understand, and then ask the question, and then gain clarity. I think it's a really great resource that a lot of grant writers, I don't think, or at least people who are writing their own grants, don't really know is available.
Yeah.
So you can just call them up or email them.
And who knows, in the course of the conversation, what other hints they might give you as to, like, they're really looking for this when they ask that.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you are having a day where you're kind of going towards the dark side and feeling all those all those feelings, are there any concrete things that you turn to again and again to kind of help you get out of it, like a book or music you listen to or something like that?
I'm a big fan of forest bathing. So spending time with trees
Nice. Is
really helpful for me, and bodies of water, if possible. Walking.
So much easier since you moved back to Seattle. This is
amazing. Very accessible. Though I did have Fort Tryon in New York because I was living in Washington Heights, which is a very beautiful park, and there's the Hudson right there, you know. So I wasn't bereft. I had my things. but that is often a go-to for me. I have been practicing a lot more social dancing lately. Last night I went Zouk dancing, for example.
What is that?
It's a Brazilian partner dance.
Oh.
Look it up. It's really cool. Dance forms where you make physical contact with somebody else.
Yeah.
And you can engage with other people and sort of like, I don't know, just sort of change your perspective a little bit. That's been helpful.
Anything else?
Cartoons. I like cartoons.
What cartoons do you like?
I've been watching Avatar, The Last Airbender.
Oh, I I've had someone else recommend that, I feel like. I've never seen it.
It's real good. It's, there's two different series. There's Avatar Aang and then Avatar Korra. And I just really enjoy them. I don't know, I like cartoons because usually the characters have like really simple, strong story arcs, like nice little hero's journey story arc going, and like strong moral compass, you know, which I appreciate. I don't like watching shows where the characters are morally bankrupt and kind of evil. I'm not interested in that. And I'm also avoiding a lot of violence. I don't want to see a lot of violence in my visual intake.
Gotcha. And then the last question is, have you seen anything recently that you want to recommend? Either something live in Seattle or a movie or anything. I mean, you just recommended the cartoon. Anything else? Or if you know of any Friends shows that you wish you could see that you want to recommend?
Well, can I tell you about the book I'm reading?
Sure.
I'm reading The Body Keeps the Score.
Okay.
By Bessel van der Kolk, who is a doctor, and it's about trauma and healing and how our stories live in our bodies and sort of the physiology of trauma.
Mm.
So far, it's very interesting.
No, that's great. That sounds really, really fascinating.
Yes. Yeah, it's sitting right over there.
Mm.
Should be cool.
Well, Lucy, those are all my questions, unless there's something that I did not ask you that you really want to talk about.
I don't know. Just be kind to yourself. I feel like artists are often very harsh on themselves, so I just wanted to remind everyone, just be kind to yourself.
Well, thank you so much for doing this, Lucy. I really appreciate it.
It is my pleasure, Miss Walsh.
Listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook, in iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.